Hello, awesome people. In today's episode, we have an interview for you with the awesome Rich. I'm not going to pronounce his last name because I get it wrong. Who would have thought? Now, this interview is going to be talking around, we dig into education quite a lot about how it all works and how it could work differently. There's a few very interesting stories in there. And we're also going to touch on workplace and, you know, actually working with dyslexia, how it works with the jobs, and a bunch of other cool dyslexic stuff. He's a very interesting man. So let's dig straight in. So welcome everybody to the podcast. I have the amazing Rich with us. Rich Rowley, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Rowley.
Gosh, what are all these terrible pronunciation-based names? It's like dyslexia. Who came up with that word? So let's dig in. So Rich, I met Rich at an awesome event he ran. You know, it was brilliant bringing together some great corporate minds who are open to neurodiversity and how it's changing. And I thought it would be more than valuable to bring him on to this podcast show thing we do and just talk about workplace, because we get a lot of questions about neurodiversity in the workplace. And I've got some great questions I'm sure Rich will give us some cool answers to. So let's dig in. I can't do him justice for a story. It's a cool story. It's a real neurodiverse story about how he got to where he is. So Rich, take it away. Tell us a little bit about yourself to start.
Broadly speaking, I work in education and learning now, and it's sort of really ironic because I was totally shit at it when I was a kid. I was primary school I can't really remember too much, but that was all right. And then my parents are like working class, and they kind of believed in the power of education to shift you out of poverty, so they worked their arse off and sent me to a private school, and I didn't want to go. And when I got there, I didn't want to be there, and I just was basically crap at learning, so I just didn't do well at school at all. So like my headmaster's comment on my final report says Rowley is not university material. And I messed about and did lots of drugs. Acid house music happened, and that was far more interesting than school and learning. So I spent a lot of time taking awesome drugs and going to awesome parties, and that was kind of like my life for a long time. It's, you know, that kind of thing. When you're not very good at school, you kind of look for other stuff and find somewhere to fit in, and it wasn't necessarily kind of the best lifestyle, but it was all right and it was fun. It does have a bit of a dark side after a while, but so I did that. I kind of messed about for a bit, and then I decided I'd better get my shit together. And I remember ringing up the local university to find out what courses that they had available, because it was like way past the start of term, and law was one of the courses that they had. And I just thought, oh, yeah, that sounds like a good job. And so I ended up getting onto a law degree, and I managed to get a law degree, but I never went. It was, like I say, I was involved in other stuff that was more interesting than lectures. Mm. So I kind of scraped through a law degree, managed to get a job as a lawyer, because the Law Society in the UK had kind of introduced this minimum wage for trainee solicitors, and nobody, there was a glut of law graduates, and nobody wanted to employ trainee solicitors. But I sort of put on a suit and knocked on doors and said, give me a job, don't pay me. And that's how I became a lawyer. I hated that. Had a few corporate jobs, like worked for big fleet car sales and for a kind of multimedia marketing company when just like kind of after the internet had just sort of started. And I kind of fell in love with computers. So I like used to go to these raves and then learned how to DJ, and then kind of got into making music and got into computers, and also through gaming as well. You know, I was always like fascinated by computer games, and I ended up doing a master's in computing. And I actually I actually got a distinction for that because it was the first time I'd ever studied anything that I was actually really interested in. And actually, I found out that I could learn and I could learn really well. Then I decided to become a teacher because for my master's project, I built a system for a group of schools. And I remember kind of standing in the school one day thinking, oh, schools are cool and I love computers. I'll be a computer teacher. And like a total dick, I became a secondary school teacher and I turned up at my first placement and it was kind of the same shit that I'd been forced to sit through just with some shiny toys. So I taught in the UK for a bit. I moved to New Zealand nearly 13 years ago. I've taught like Decile 10 school on the shore and Decile 2 school in South Auckland. But I was mostly involved with kind of network and infrastructure sort of stuff and D&E learning, trying to get teachers into using technology. And then like 5 years ago, I got asked by a woman called Frances Valentine to come and work with her at a place called the Mind Lab, which was this sort of education startup, which it's got this mission statement that says to transform education to make it better fit the needs of contemporary business. So there's this kind of massive gap between what schools kick out and what the world needs. And Francis is really committed to trying to change that. So for 5 years, I've worked there. So that was running the kids programs, delivering their teacher training course. There's a postgraduate qualification aimed at getting teachers to like look at the practice and improve it. And that now I kind of work in the corporate side of their business, Tech Futures Lab, working on innovation stuff with big corporates, and also I supervise master's candidates here. But it's been just a really, I might cry a bit when it's sorry.
Cry, swear, enjoy yourself.
Yeah, well, it's been quite a mad place for me to come and work because I found out I got ADHD a few years ago. And when I found out I got ADHD, and you know, there's all these wonderfully named comorbidities that I've got as well. So I'm a mixed bag of disses and all sorts of stuff. But when I found out, it was like, oh, well, that explains a lot. But I felt kind of embarrassed about it. So I never really told anybody. And, you know, that's why kind of school was really not my cup of tea. And I never really found a job that I've always just struggled in jobs, every single job. That's kind of why I liked a lot of the computing stuff, because I could just sort of lock myself away in a room in front of a computer, you know, and get on and not really have to deal with people. So, but then I came to work at the Mind Lab, and it was really the first time I sort of had to stop worrying about all the stuff that I'm not good at. Because we basically, it was a kind of small education startup, and we really collaborated. So, and that's really hard. People don't get collaboration because the best I've ever seen anywhere other than here is like, you know, cooperation. And there's quite a difference, because to collaborate, it comes from a point of vulnerability. So you have to actually talk to the people that you work with about all the stuff that you're not good at. And one of my great friends, Damon Carhey, who was on the team at the Mind Lab when I started, he kind of set the tone for that. He'll hate me. He's just really kind of humble, but he hates being talked about, but he's the best man I know. And on the first day I went to work with him, he introduced himself and he was like, oh, hi, I'm Damon, welcome. And then he started saying, you know, oh, there's some stuff that you need to know about me, and started talking to me about all the stuff that he had. You know, he's neurodiverse, he's dyslexic, and he just, you know, it was quite unusual just being meeting somebody for the first time that you're going to work with, and they were telling you all these things about them. But it was great because all of a sudden you knew, well, Damon's dyslexic. He doesn't like reading and writing too much. And I was like, oh, I frigging hate writing as well. It's like my kryptonite. So, but the weird thing is there's other people in the team who love that stuff. You know, they're like, I love writing. You do all the writing and we just won't bother. So, it was just, you know, where it was working with a purpose, which was cool, that we all really loved, and it was just really collaborative. And then even though I had that, I kind of hadn't really talked about my differences, and so that how that came about. I was on the board of my daughter's school, and one evening at the end of a board meeting, we went into a closed session because there was basically a six-year-old kid who'd been excluded, and basically the board have to go through the legislation to decide what happens. And you've got, like, the choices are really shit because the legislation's awful, but you've kind of got three choices: to bring them back with conditions, or to exclude them. And we ended up having to exclude this six-year-old kid. He was just going through the diagnosis process, but he got ADHD, got oppositional defiance disorder. And this kid was basically kind of me, age six, and it just destroyed me at the board meeting. And I was, you know, I was really fighting to keep him in school. And I ended up telling the board members. It was really the kind of first time I'd told anybody. And, you know, so it was really upsetting. I went home that night, sort of meditated, made my peace with it all, and got up the next day, came to work, and work's like my happy place. So I was okay. And then one of the board members rang me up to see if I was all right, and it just wiped me out again. So I ended up going for a coffee with my boss's PA, Melissa, and just telling her about it. And she kept saying, oh, you need to tell Francis. And I spoke to my ex-wife about it. My ex-wife does HR and recruitment, and, you know, she didn't think it was a good idea to tell my boss about it.
They never do.
Yeah. But basically, Melissa kind of grabbed me one morning and pushed me into Francis's office and just said, oh, Rich needs to tell you something. And so I was like, oh, well, you know, I've got ADHD and I've got this and I've got that. And it was just quite a pivotal moment because the first thing she said was, oh, I knew. And I was like, oh, fuck, I thought I was doing a better job of hiding it. But she said, I didn't know what you got. She said, but I knew you were different, and that's why I wanted you to work for me. And that was sort of quite a profound moment because I never really considered that my ADHD and the way that I think differently was actually something of value. Mm-hmm. And it really made me kind of stop and reframe me and my brain, and, you know, all the stuff that I'm good at and all the stuff that I'm not very good at. And yeah, I mean, that would just kind of, it changed a lot of things. So I ended up getting in touch with the ADHD Foundation and wanting to help them, and they struggle with education. Anyway, long story short, that I'm kind of, although I've kind of got my day job, I'm also really, I've got this like 5-year goal now to change the world for neurodiverse people. Because it, you know, I think pre-industrial revolution, we were kind of like the creative people. You know, I read a lot about ADHD in particular. And, you know, if you look at people in the past who had it, there's some profound thinkers who psychologists reckon were definitely ADHD. So, you know, you've got Rousseau, Leonardo da Vinci was most likely ADHD. And so we used to kind of thrive in the past. And then you had this industrial model of society that came along where you just want compliant, conformist thinkers, and we're just never going to be that, and so we just don't fit in. And so for quite a long time, we've just had you know, it's been hard. So neurodiverse people are the biggest biggest proportion of the unemployment statistics in New Zealand. We're really heavily overly represented in the criminal justice system. So it's because we don't fit in like those neurotypical boxes that for a while have been what society's kind of demanded. But I think the great thing now is the space I work in, it's all these companies coming and going, oh, we're crap at collaboration and, you know, we're really crap at innovation. And I'm like, no shit, Sherlock, that's kind of what the school system's done to the way you think. But guess what? There are these people who are neurodiverse and you know, they think differently, and that's where innovation comes from. And
do you find that's where that they kind of click? And it was interesting listening to you talk about Da Vinci. I was, funny enough, looking at a list of dyslexics, and he's on there as well because the connection's so tight. Yeah. And what was cracking me up is on this list, it's the only list in the world where Galileo and Noel Gallagher are on the same list. It's like I was cracking up. It's like a singer from Oasis and bloody a world, you know, a famous person, you know, a thinker, you know. And it's so interesting. I love your you know, I've used it a few times now, that whole industrial kind of revolution and how it went away from the inventors and the people that were creating the world being the leaders and turning into a very industrial level world. And now it's kind of gone the other way. We've found a way of getting robots and computers to take on a lot of those roles. And it's now coming back to the thinkers that are going to be the leaders again. And it's such an interesting diversion, isn't it?
Oh, it's I mean, it's fascinating, but it's about bloody time, basically, that we're allowed to shine again. But I mean, the implications of it are massive. So through work, when I started at the Mind Lab on the teacher training course that we do, we started playing this. We used to teach teachers about agile and this kind of like open source agile starter game, and it's played by thousands of people. So on face value, it's about self-organizing teams, quick iterative cycles, and how you can actually improve really quickly over time within like an agile framework. But I'm not going to give away my kind of trade secret, but let's just say there's some profound implications for neurodiverse people and innovation that came out of that game, you know. And I didn't understand what was going on at first when I noticed it. I just noticed this really profound thing about how people play the game. And I went away and I read lots of research. You know, I went all over the place. I ended up like Machiavelli, The Prince, and Foucault's quite interesting because that's, you know, I've always thought that the school system's been like this kind of almost like prison. And then like I read Foucault and I was like, Jesus, this guy was writing this stuff like 100 years ago. You know, and we've very much got this education system that's about conformity, compliance, control, and the world of work's kind of been like that for a long time. But like you say, we've now got these new technologies coming along, which a lot of that kind of neurotypical process structure logical stuff, that's what machines are bloody great at. And so, you know, all these organizations now are facing the challenge, actually, you know, machines are going to come along and do a lot of this stuff. What are the people going to do? And you know, neurodiverse people are just frigging awesome you know, being creative and seeing things differently is a fucking superpower. It's bloody amazing. And the game that I play gives real insights into that, like phenomenal insights. And so that's kind of a lot of the stuff that I do with organizations that I work with, kind of getting individuals in organizations to kind of recognize how they think. So we don't kind of talk about neurotypical and neurodivergent. We kind of call it like samurai and ninja thinking. So samurai thinkers are kind of the more logical, process structured thinkers. And ninjas are, you know, neurodiverse people, the ones who, like, everybody, this is the other thing, is it drives me frigging mad. You hear it all the time, out of the box thinking. It's like, fucking newsflash, there's no box. Just making up the boxes. You know, and like, you know, school stuck your head in lots of boxes, and
it really has.
Your head in not lots of boxes, and it's like, guess what? My head's in totally different frigging boxes, and that's where creativity comes from. It's that kind of difference of.
I think we also ask, and we'll touch on neurodiversity a bit more, but we also ask this question of, we ask questions of things that people don't ask questions of. Like I was thinking the other day, someone said the old saying, never meet your heroes. And I was thinking about that, and I was like, that's a stupid saying, because if you met your heroes and saw that they weren't as amazing as you may have thought, you would then be able to go, actually, they're like me. I can reach that level.
Why wouldn't
you want to meet your heroes? Why did some genius come up with a stupid saying like that? And I said that to someone, and they go, "Oh, that makes sense." But they'd never thought of it like that, and gone, "It's just amazing the amount of repetition people say without knowing what it means." And my brain just went off into this whole different tangent.
I mean, there's this kind of compulsion to conform. You know, and that's that, once again, that's kind of one of the things that school system does, you know, it's and so, you know, most people tend to be conformist, and I've never been that, you know. It's before I knew about my ADHD and stuff, I've always felt odd. I used to walk around when I was a kid feeling like I was frigging alien, because I couldn't understand. You know, I'd come home from school and I'd have homework to do, and I couldn't do it. And I knew that when I went to school the next day, you know, from some of the teachers, I'd be in for a bloody slipper in, but I still couldn't do my frigging homework. And I'd just be walking around fields thinking, should be doing my homework. Why aren't I doing my homework? I can't do my homework. And like just sort of wondering what it was about, and never had answers. And so I've never felt like I've conformed, you know. It's like, that's why I loved when acid house music came out. It was this kind of counterculture revolution stuff, and all of a sudden there were all these other people who just weren't conforming and doing stuff that society said, oh, you know, that's bad. And
it's so big though. Like I was sitting down with a dyslexic guy who's also helping us with the truth about dyslexia. And we had such mirrored stories when we talked to each other. And he remembered that he would never do his spelling homework ever. And he got to a point where the teacher just said, you know where the detention slip is, go and fill it in yourself. And this guy is running a business, a multi-million dollar business he's built with his partner in a design industry. That's just amazing. And he's, you know, he's learned a lot along the way. He's had his challenges, but this guy was someone who couldn't even do spelling homework and literally wrote his own detention slips at school. And this is, you know, it kind of sickens me a little bit, but it's such a, I'm hearing this story again and again and again, and it's the school system's shite, really.
I mean, it's really odd. So it's kind of nobody's fault. I mean, one of the things that gets me is, you know, it's, so the program that worked out at the Mind Lab, that was the biggest in-service teacher training program in Asia Pacific. It was massive. And I think it's really helped kind of move practice along in New Zealand in primary schools. But the problem is, the whole system kind of works to maintain the status quo. You know, there's this massive homeostasis. So by the time you get into secondary schools, you know, it's kind of becomes high stakes, because there's a game mechanic behind it. So the whole system operates on, you know, how many NCEA credits kids get, you know, and it's a game mechanic, and everybody starts playing the game. Everybody plays the game. So, you know, you might get teachers who want to do inspirational stuff, but if they start doing that, the kids will go, don't care about that. Tell me what I need to do to get credits. Or the parents will be like, why are you doing this stuff? We want our kids to get credits, you know, and it's just a hard system to change. You know, it's like every parent wants what's best for the kids. And if you're the kind of parent who's, you know, done well at school and got a good job, and you kind of see that, well, that's the kind of path that my children need to take. You know, they do well at school, they get the bit of paper, they go to university, they'll get a good job and have a good career like I am. And, you know, so it's trying to break down all of those things. It's just really hard. You've got a few hundred years worth of history there that you're trying to.
Well, funny we're talking about this, because I have a weird fetish, which is to listen to the BBC Five live over in England. But I listen to it at night before I go to bed. So I listen to their morning radio and their podcast. I managed to download the app when I was in England. And I just love the British accent for that type of thing. So I was listening to one of the girls talking to a politician. And what they're trying to do in schools over there is introduce new standards for rating school quality. So what they've kind of realized is they've got a table of results that already exists. But they also have another form of measurement, which used to be very based on the table of results. But this new educator has come in and said, actually, we're going to change it to be quality of education. So when people judge what school to send their kids to, they're not only judging based on the results these kids are getting, but are the kids actually having a good experience? Are they learning everything they need to? Because in England, they were finding that teachers were under-resourced. So they basically teach the tests.
Oh, yeah. Everybody does that. So there's in education, there's this saying, it's like the pedagogy of the assessment drives the pedagogy of the classroom. That's true. You know, as long as you've got some kind of test that the whole system is judged on the outcome of that test.
Yeah.
So the kids are judged on it. The schools are judged on it. The teachers are judged on it. The government at some points and their education policy is judged on it. Everybody's judged on it. And what nobody sort of steps back and says is, it's a frigging game mechanic. And when you've got a game mechanic, people play the bloody game to get the best results. And it's, you know, it's really mad. It's I do this thing called first principles thinking, which is where you kind of strip everything back to what we actually know, and then you start again. And if you were to design a learning system for kids and adults, it wouldn't look anything like schools. Because schools are not about learning. You know, it's like, and some people will argue that, yes, they are. But I'd actually say I totally counteract that. You know, in primary schools, yes, to a certain extent. But by the time you get to secondary schools, it's nothing to do with learning. It's about getting kids a bit of paper.
Yeah.
You know, when people talk, like, you know, you'll get people going, oh, but it is. And we do this and we do this and we're trying all these wonderful things. But it's fundamentally, it's about that bit of paper at the end of the day. And that's the problem, because it should just be about kids. And that's, once again, that's another thing that's given me a bit of a kick up my arse. So, you know, there's no genuine free alternative to mainstream education in New Zealand. You know, you've got state schools, state integrated schools, and private schools. And all private schools do is the same stuff that state schools do. They just, they've got shinier stuff, lower class sizes, and charge more money. And, you know, but they're all doing the same thing. They're all teaching the same kind of curriculum. They've all got this age and stage thing. You know, you go to a secondary school down the road here, a state school, they've got year levels, and kids are doing different things in these year levels. Mm. You go to a private school, exactly the same. And that, you know, that's not based in neuroscience. You know, this stupid idea that because you're the same age that you all need to learn the same stuff at the same time, that's just... it's nonsense.
Crazy, eh?
And then you're making them learn all of these things that have got no context, and, you know, they're bloody useless. I couldn't do maths when I was at school. I failed maths. I was just crap at it. I couldn't do it. A couple of years ago, I did a course on writing algorithms to control qubits, like... and that's kind of like some of the maths in that's like postdoctoral maths. So I can do bloody maths now. Couldn't do it at school. And it's like, why is it so important that by the age of 16, every kid can do all of this math stuff? It's
but Rich, how will you ever know if train A is going at 20 miles an hour and train B is going at...
Who fucking cares about any of that shit?
Well, what does X mean? What does X mean? No,
But it's like writing as well. It's writing for me is torture.
Yeah.
you know, and it's always been really hard. And basically what it is, my brain goes really fast. Every time like I try to write with a pen and paper, it's like my brain's gone and I'm constantly having to pull it back to think, and even typing's just hard. And it's like you've got people in schools, I mean, you're basically torturing them. But you get these neurotypical people going, oh, well, you just need to practice more, or all this.
Actually, no.
Our brains are fundamentally frigging different, and you're making us do something that actually fucking hurts, and that's torture. And it's
like putting someone who is allergic to mushrooms on an all mushroom diet and then wondering out why they're not losing weight and being healthy, isn't it?
Yeah. It's nuts, but this is the problem. It's kind of like a neurotypical world, and it's a neurotypical education system, and neurotypical people genuinely don't understand our perspective. And I think one of the things is that the kind of neurodiverse population, we've not really stood up for ourselves. I think it's just beginning. I think neurotypical people are actually beginning to say, actually, this is me, and it's all right to be me, and there's nothing wrong with me. It's you and the rest of you that need to change, you know. So school needs to change to make account of us and our differences. We don't have to change to fit into their model. Their model needs to change, and the world of work needs to change as well. And it can, you know, it's like I love coming to work every day at Tech Futures because I can just be me. And that's a frigging profound thing. You know, I can just be me with all the stuff that I'm not good at and the stuff that I'm good at, and I can have a fulfilling job that I love, and I'm, you know, I'm happy. And I do think, you know, it's just at the start of actual us beginning to say, we don't need to change, you need to change your stuff. And
I think that's key. And this is you know, this is what I'm seeing as well. And I think I was just going to raise a point around, just for the listeners, you know, we talk a lot about dyslexia, but the more I'm doing research, the more I'm seeing people work. Being neurotypical, what we're kind of talking is a collective thing around ADHD, dyslexia, dyscalculia, add every other stupid word that's been invented.
Yeah.
It's really those right brain challenges, the people that think with their pictures, that are struggling with symbols, and there's a bunch of other stuff. I'm not going to go into exact details, but it's the people who think predominantly with the picture side of their mind that struggle with doing a lot of writing, because I couldn't write very well at all. And doesn't mean I'm stupid. What they standardly find is your IQ is naturally higher on a lot of people. We just can't get our information out of our bloody heads to do anything with it, which is the bugger. And, that's the killer of it all. And this is, you know, I was thinking one of the other things around what I really liked about what you were saying the other day around neurodiversity is you're seeing a lot of companies going after specific challenges like autism, ADHD, dyslexia, even in some cases.
Yeah.
But I loved your example of how it's kind of like a company, and I won't use a company's name so you don't associate them, but say a company came out and said, you know, we're only going to recognize gay males in our organization or with the work we're doing. That's what it's kind of like if they talk about just one neurodiverse cause as opposed to a bunch, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, this is how the world is. It's this area of diversity that really has just not been touched on at all. And it's not organizations' fault. You know, it's great you're doing something for autistic people. That's one of these diversities. And it is, it's exactly, you know, you'd slate an organization that came out and went, oh, now we care about homosexual men, so we've got a recruitment policy and, you know, we've got training around it so that they feel accepted. You know, that would cause mass controversy because everybody would just be going, well, what about all the other gender diversities? You know, you can't just cherry pick one yet. Because it's neurodiversity, it's like, oh, we're doing this thing for autistic people. And everybody's like, wow, aren't you amazing? And it's like, actually, well, good for you. But what about all the other neurodiversities as well? You know, and it's just this whole area that really nobody in the world's really begun to address seriously. And like I say, I think part of it is that, you know, I meet lots of neurodiverse people, and they tend to be like I was when I first found out, particularly adults, because most adults I meet, you know, they didn't kind of find out about themselves until they were quite old. And then they've got this kind of embarrassment thing about it. It's because it's all of the language around it is all deficit language. You know, you diss this, you diss that, you've got comorbidities. And
yeah, what a horrible
word. It's not exactly positive, is it? You know, it's not, they don't go, bloody hell, Rich, you've got ADHD, you've got frigging superpowers. It's not like that, is it? But it's actually, we've got superpowers. We've got, like everybody who I meet is neurodiverse, can do, the brains are just beautiful and they just work in ways that neurotypical people's brains don't. I mean, but the thing is with that as well, the world would be shit if it was full of people like me, because nothing would ever get done. You know,
we need slaves, Rich. We need slaves. Well, people to action our ideas.
People can like kind of take it and make shit happen, because it's like, I mean, that's why for a couple of the projects that I work on, you know, I work with some awesome people, and you know, they're much more neurotypical, and it just works really well, because it's one, they can kind of give me a push to do the stuff that I need to do that I kind of lose a bit of interest in. And two, they do all the stuff that I'm never going to have any interest in anyway. And it just gets stuff done. And I think that's the kind of sweet spot. If you want to kind of change things and change the world, you kind of have to celebrate what your strengths are as a neurodiverse person, which for a lot of us is incredibly hard. Mm-hmm. But then you also have to really own your weaknesses as well, and then find those other people who can fill in for that. And that's kind of when the magic happens, when you've got those two bits that come together. And
that's a great turning point for the conversation. We've talked about education, but what I wanted to also touch on at the end of this interview is around, well, this chat, catch up, I don't know what we call it these days, stupid words. But talking about workplace, you know, you've had the experience of talking to your boss. You've been in a very fortunate position. What advice from what you've seen in the workplace world would you give to someone who knows they're neurodiverse, but maybe they've hidden it when they've started work, or maybe they're getting another job and they're scared to talk about it? What would you say to someone like that?
Man, it's really tough, because I mean, this is the problem at the moment. I totally understand why people are reticent about going to their employers and saying something, because everybody just perceives these things as negative stuff. And, you know, that's the project that I'm working on is very much about changing that. It's about educating everybody about what the different neurodiversities actually are, and that the fact that neurodiverse people come with these whole load of benefits. And it's about trying to change the school and work environment, so that what I would like to see happen over the next couple of years in New Zealand would be that if you are neurodiverse and you are going to work for a company, that if the company we're doing this like micro credential learning app, and they'll get a kind of, everybody can get a tick, you know, these days, but it's a game mechanic and it works and companies love it. So, you know, but I mean, the idea would be that if I went to work for a company and they got our accreditation, that I would actually feel secure in having that conversation with the HR department and saying, look, you know, this is me, I've got these things and I need a bit more support. And they straight away know what kind of support to give. And actually it would just be a more supportive environment. And because when you get the bits of support around the stuff that you're not good at, you can focus on the stuff you're good at. And that's when you begin to flourish. And at the moment,
it's hard, eh?
It's just a nightmare. It's very, very much like, you know, the kind of gay pride movement where, the 60s and 70s, you know, not many people back then actually had the kind of confidence and the ability to come out and say, this is me. And that's very much the same for our community now. It's you could actually be doing yourself a major disservice by actually kind of coming out and saying it. And that's just bloody wrong. But that's where we're at the moment. But
how do you know who's a Nazi and how do you know who's an ally? Isn't it like it's how does Anne Frank know who to talk to? You know, and we get stuck in the attic. You know, because you're scared of what's the next step. That's quite a specific example, but you get the concept of where I'm going. It's, you know, some people like your boss was very accepting. You know, I am as a boss very accepting. I don't care whatever you are, as long as you do your work. Yeah. I don't care if you're an alien or a cat, but just get the work done. You know, but a lot of people don't have that same awareness. And it's, do you know what I mean? It's kind of hard to work it out. Maybe there are questions they could ask. Who knows? I've always wanted to help answer this question, but it's such a, do you know what I mean? It's such an individual question. You're going to have to really feel your boss out. Nine times out of 10, I say don't even tell anybody. Maybe your recruiter if you trust them, but don't, because I know a couple of recruiters who are great and they will really work on driving the value of a dyslexic, especially into things like being a product manager and a bunch of other professions where it is such a benefit.
It's just where we're at the moment, and I think I'm really optimistic. Like I say, I've got this in 5 years time, I want that to have totally changed.
You know, and
it's meeting people like you who are kind of in the same space wanting to do the same thing, and I think it's just the beginnings of this movement where we're actually beginning to go, actually, you know, we can work together, we can do some stuff, we can educate the corporates, we can do more stuff in school. I think the great thing for me, you know, like that event that we did, that you came along to at Simpson Grayson, you know, I had to go out and have a little cry before I started it because I was just a bit overwhelmed by how many people had turned. You know, it was on a work day in the morning, you know, it was basically half a day out of your week for some really kind of important, influential people. And it was like actually just a bit overwhelming how many people had wanted to attend and just how well received it is. So I think there's this, it's really gratifying that there's kind of this growing awareness of it. And I just think, I don't know, I think the next couple of years in New Zealand are going to be amazing. And I actually think that we're kind of going to lead the way for the rest of the world. You know, we're really lucky in New Zealand. When we pitched our idea to some of the neurodiverse foundations, one of the women made a comment that, oh, this is awesome. You know, that she was like, oh, New Zealand was first for women's suffrage. And I think it was first for, you know, gender diversity rights. And she's like, you know, that now we're going to be first for neurodiverse rights. And I actually think that's probably right. You know, I think this is an area where New Zealand can be seen to be world leaders. And it's just fucking awesome to be part of actually making a change, because it's bloody beyond time that, you know, it's about time that neurodiverse people can stand up and just say, this is me, and you know, you need to support me a little bit more with some stuff at work or wherever. And we shouldn't be ashamed or embarrassed, because it's
well, and this is the thing, is that the neurodiverse mind is so powerful. And it's like I was talking about it the other day. Like I do a talk to a bunch of new business startups around digital marketing, and they always give me a point to pitch at the end and talk about what I do. And usually I talk about websites and design and stuff. And this time I stood up and said, if you know anyone who's dyslexic, listen to my podcast. So I was more proud of that than my work. It was hilarious. And I was really, and I had a bunch of people really interested in it, which was fantastic. And it was, you know, I'm the same as you. I just think we are at the beginning of a massive wave.
Yeah.
And New Zealand can lead the world, but I think as well we can help the UK, we can help the US, the rest of the world, to see what these changes will really mean And there's this, as I said, talking to this other guy, he talked about there's so much waste in business. So much waste. And it was such an interesting term because I hadn't looked at it like that, of efficiency and effectiveness because of lack of acceptance, understanding. And he talked a lot about emotional connection. And he just said, if you could get that right, you could double productivity from doing nothing more than just accepting each other and understanding each other.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, I mean, diversity is, yeah, this is one of the great things. So innovation comes from diversity. That's it. You know, the more diverse your workforce is, the better you're going to be at innovating if you can leverage that diversity. And if you recognize it, and if you really understand it, and it's not about diversities. Yes, it is about gender and culture and religion and all those things, but actually at a deeper level, it's really about diversity of thought.
Mm.
And that's like the key to kind of innovation and you know, empathy for other people who are different as well. That's key. So once you can empathize with people who are different, that's when, you know, your workplace becomes better and happier. And that's when the stuff that you work does becomes better, because you're actually, empathy is a massive part. And in fact, World Economic Forum, the big global threats report 2019, they had like 4 pages, I think it was, just dedicated to empathy.
Wow.
So that understanding people's differences is massive, and it's really important. And the better that we get at that as a society, the better we're going to be. And I just think it's just an awesome time and place, especially, you know, I'm gobsmacked the kind of organizations that come here and they get this like weird, sweary bloke from Stoke in workshops with them on like, we're like sort of weird stuff. And it's, I sort of can't quite believe what I do for a job now, and that these organizations are kind of coming for this kind of thinking. But I mean, it's kind of great, because it's like, wow, there's a need for people who think differently. And it is kind of time for the neurodiverse population, I think, to sort of come out of the shadows again and start thriving again. And it'll take time, and there's a lot of work involved in it, but
yeah,
it's just bloody good.
Oh, that's awesome, mate. That's been fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. I've really appreciated it. And I'm sure everyone will love hearing what you've got to say, because it's so prominent on people's minds. And maybe we can have you back on in a year's time, and let's do an update on the brain badge.